Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend, a compilation of many of the stories and features from the past week. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. The U.S. bade farewell Wednesday to its former president, George H.W. Bush, at a state funeral in Washington, attended by top American political figures along with current and former leaders from throughout the world. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman was there. Steve, what happened?
Well, this was really a remarkable scene in the National Cathedral, where 94-year-old George Herbert Walker Bush was eulogized, including by his son, who was the 43rd president of the United States, George W. Bush, saying that his father had taught us public service was noble and necessary, and he had enormous capacity to give of himself. Now, we did not hear from the current president, Donald Trump. That was basically at the request of the late president and a break from recent tradition. But the president did tweet before the service that he was looking forward to it, and he said, "This is not a funeral. This is a day of celebration for a great man who has led a long and distinguished life. He will be missed." Of course, it was a funeral, a state funeral, and the first time we've seen this for a president in a dozen years. And it was a very interesting scene when the president and the first lady came into the cathedral, and there already in the first rows were former presidents of the United States, including Trump's immediate predecessor, Barack Obama. The president did reach out to his predecessor. They shook hands. But really, the tension was palpable in the first row of those pews, and we really did not see Trump and Obama speak after that.
You know, it really was a celebration in many ways, and there were some very lighthearted and funny moments.
One of the speakers at this service was a former U.S. senator from the state of Wyoming, Alan Simpson, who really was a close friend of President Bush and socialized with him. And he told some jokes and said that his friend was a class act from birth to death, and eulogized him as one of nature's noble men. And we also heard from a presidential historian, John Meacham. And of course, this was somebody that the late president wanted to speak at this service. And he hailed George H.W. Bush as America's last great soldier statesman, someone who made our lives and the lives of nations freer, better, nobler, and warmer. And that international aspect to the Bush presidency was very much on display. Former Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, also one of the people giving a eulogy, and some of the other dignitaries inside the cathedral from overseas, Prince Charles of Britain, the King and Queen of Jordan, the current German Chancellor, the Polish President, and former presidents from several countries, as well as former prime ministers from such countries as Britain and Japan and Kuwait.
What is next as far as the continuing praise, the continuing remembrance of George H.W. Bush?
There will be a service on Thursday at an Episcopal church in Houston, and then the late president embarks on his final 120-kilometer ride on Locomotive 4141. It's a special train. It'll have the blue and white paint scheme of Air Force One. And it travels to College Station. That is a city in Texas, the home of Texas A&M University. And there, Bush will be laid to rest at his presidential library on the grounds of the school, alongside his wife Barbara, who died earlier this year, and their daughter Robin, who succumbed in childhood to leukemia.
You know, what was really apparent watching the service was how much love was shown to this man.
You know, George H.W. Bush, and this came up during the service, was someone who really cherished every day he was alive. He didn't take it for granted because of what happened to him in the Second World War. He parachuted out of his plane, which had been shot down He fell into the Pacific Ocean, and by chance, a U.S. Navy submarine picked him up before he ended up in the hands of the Japanese. And he suffered some injuries in that harrowing escape. His two others in the plane did not survive. He never forgot that. And he really felt he was called to service, and it was important to make every day of his life significant. I think what is also remarkable about the life of this president, in contrast to others who catapult quite quickly to the highest office, and we, of course, the current president of the United States had never held elected office before, George H.W. Bush was very well prepared for the job. He had been an envoy to China. He had been ambassador to the United Nations. He was the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. He served in Congress. And, of course, he was vice president before becoming president. So in recent decades, someone who came from a political family, of also from a family that was quite elite and well off, from a generation where those were the types of people who were expected to end up in the highest office. And also, of course, remarkably, only the second time in history for a president to be succeeded by his son.
VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Steve, thanks so much. The world's two largest economies, the U.S. and China, have agreed to a small truce in their escalating trade war after a meeting between Presidents Donald Trump and Xi Jinping following the G20 summit. Trump, speaking to reporters on Air Force One after the plane departed Argentina, said his agreement made over dinner with Xi will go down as one of the largest deals ever made. And it'll have an incredibly positive impact on farming, meaning agriculture, industrial products, computers, and every type of product. Trump agreed that he will leave the tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese products at the 10% rate and not raise it to 25% for now, as he had threatened to do come January 1st, according to a White House statement. I spoke via Skype with Phil Levy, a senior fellow on the global economy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. From 2003 to 2006, he served first as senior economist for trade for President George W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisors, and then as a member of Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's policy planning staff covering international economic matters.
It is a small truce. It means that for the moment, the more pragmatic set of advisors for the president have won out, and they're pushing for talks that might lead to a lowering of tariff barriers. I think I would expect, though, that we have not solved this problem for the long run, because the other set of advisors, the ones who cautioned exactly against accepting some baubles and ongoing talks, they're still there, and I can't imagine they like this one bit.
Where do you think Trump really stands on this?
I think President Trump wavers. I think on the one hand, he buys into many of the critiques that, you know, there's fundamental issues with China that need to be addressed. On the other hand, he likes to cut a deal and a quick deal. And those two desires are inconsistent. The kind of problems that they've been flagging with China, such as subsidies, regulatory problems, intellectual property issues, those are things that are difficult and subtle and take a long time to work out. They're not things you fix over dinner. So what we end up with is sort of an awkward compromise where you give yourself 90 days to tackle problems that have plagued us for years.
What do you think happens next? What are the next steps here?
They've given themselves a very short time frame. I mean, they're talking about 90 days, and it's worth remembering that's 90 days that contain, you know, Christmas and New Year's in the U.S. and then Chinese New Year for them. So this is not much time to work on things. I think we have a little stretch here where we've essentially postponed tariffs for 2 months, and then the Trump administration is going to have to make a decision. Do they snap back to their escalation and complaints, or do they try for some face-saving resolution?
You can't be in their shoes, as you can't be in the U.S. negotiator's shoes, but as far as the Chinese are concerned, where do you think they're coming from?
I think the Chinese have found the Trump administration baffling. It's worth remembering, this is not the first deal that the Trump administration has struck, nor is it even the first deal that that President Trump has, you know, paraded around as a fantastic, fabulous, you know, historic agreement. We had one in the spring of his very first year. And then after the glow wore off, they went right back to doing trade battles. He had his visit to Beijing in November of last year. It was wonderful. It was fabulous. No one's ever been treated as nicely. And then they launched into all of these tariffs. So I think the Chinese think they're playing for time and they'll just take whatever comes next.
I'm trying to figure out where Xi Jinping might go from here beside waiting. Are there any steps he might take, either positively or negatively, to go further?
I think there's a range of things that China can do which are within sort of a reasonable realm. I think it has probably come as a bit of a shock to them, the extent to which they have lost the support of the U.S. business community. And you've seen requests coming out of the U.S. business community, things that they could do in terms of treating foreign investment, in terms of dealing with intellectual property. He would be well advised to try and address some of those concerns that have been raised. There's also the sort of very standard offers that one can make of lowering some tariffs, agreeing to make some extra purchases. And I think they've tried that, although they didn't lay out the details after this dinner. That's my guess of his next move. If the holdout is for fundamental, deep Chinese reforms at, you know, U.S. insistence, that's not going to happen, at least not in the very short run.
The two of us have talked in the past about the security that China was offered, or lack of so. And you have apparently some promises when it comes to that. And you also have the agreement by China to designate fentanyl as a controlled substance. But what are your reactions to those things?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, so we saw these two things which do not count as traditional trade issues. One, the fentanyl, and then the other, some talk about how to deal with North Korea, that were both raised. I think this is China pulling some strings and reminding the president that there's other aspects to this relationship and it may be worth preserving. So these were things that allowed the president a bit more of a face-saving exit from the tariffs he had planned, or at least a postponement. It's that what was not touched were the kind of security concerns that Vice President Mike Pence raised a month or two ago about China. So that kind of cuts both ways. In this case, it was used as an excuse to postpone the tariffs.
President Trump had comments about China and other topics at the G20 summit in Argentina, which he shared with VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren.
As you call out China as one of the countries you say is ripping off the United States, China's global footprint is expanding. They're all over North Africa. They're building a huge port in Pakistan. They have great deals, investment deals in Panama and Latin America, sort of coming very close to the United States geographically. Do you trust the strategic goals of China, or are you a little bit worried?
Well, I think they're going to have less money than they have right now because the deal that I'm making, if you look at, we have $250 billion right now at 25%. That means we're going to be taking in billions and billions of dollars. Plus, I can double that up and then I can double it again. And they could never do what they did in the past with other presidents because, and you see what's happening. I mean, China is, I don't want to do this, but they are not doing very well now compared to what they were doing. And again, I think that we are doing well. We picked up $11.7 trillion in worth since my election, and China's lost a great deal of worth. And we are now a much bigger economy than China, which a lot of people don't know, but we're a much bigger and really a much more powerful economy than China.
But as a national security point, you know, with their investment in Latin America and all over the world, it does seem that they're making a bigger footprint around the world.
I know, but they have a debt problem, and they have to pay for that debt. It's a tremendous amount of money that they're spending. Do I like it? Probably not, but I also know it's very expensive for them, and a lot of those places aren't going to work out.
One of the issues of a global economy is climate change. That's a discussion here. What's your position on climate change and how it has an effect on the economy worldwide?
Very simple. I want the cleanest air and the cleanest water on the planet. I want crystal clean water, and that's what we have. We've been doing very well with respect to the environment, and that's what I want. But I'm not going to put the country out of business trying to maintain certain standards that probably don't matter. When you look at China and when you look at other countries where they have very, you know, foul air, they have not good air, that comes over to the United States. You know, people don't want to talk about it, but it comes over. So we're going to be clean, but they're not, and it costs a lot of money. Well, the fact is, we are absolutely clean, but we're not going to spend trillions of dollars and make it good for others, but not make it good for... You know, I have a very simple policy. It's called America First. At the same time, we're going to be a great neighbor to the world, but we have to treat ourselves fairly. So that's the way it is.
All right. Now, our domestic economy. Next week, there's a vote, possibly, on a government shutdown. First of all, do you think there is going to be a U.S. government shutdown, and does that have any sort of global economic impact?
Well, I can't tell you if there's going to be a shutdown because nobody knows, but I will tell you we're going to have border security. We're going to have a lot of border security. You saw what we did with the all of the caravans coming up, and now they're starting to head out. They're starting to go back. But we are going to have security. We're not going to let people come into our country illegally. We're going to have people come in on merit. We need people. You know, we have the lowest unemployment rate we've had in 51 years. We need people in this country. We have companies moving in. In fact, Prime Minister Abe of Japan just told me they're moving two big car companies. They're going to be opening up two massive plants. You know, you don't hear that often, but a lot of that is happening. You hear about a General Motors, and I don't know what happened with General Motors, but the trend is exactly the opposite. And I will say this, our economy has never done better. We're doing unbelievable numbers. You see that. And a lot of good things are happening.
All right. One last question, and I'll give you a chance to educate there, at least talk about the American media. What is it the U.S. media collectively doesn't understand about the economy when you look at things, you hear our reporting? Any thoughts about our reporting?
Well, I think they understand the economy. They know how well we're doing. They just don't like to say it because that's good for me. So they don't want to say it. You know, look, I call it fake news. I don't say the media. I say you have so much false reporting. But we have a phenomenal economy. They know that. Look, we have the best unemployment numbers as a group that we've ever had. You look at African-American unemployment and Asian and Hispanic-American. You look at all of it, they're the best numbers in history. The best, I mean, these are historic lows. So the media knows how well we're doing. They tend not to want to write it.
So you like discussing the economy of these world leaders?
I do. I mean, we have the best economy in the world. Actually, every leader came up to me virtually, and they said, congratulations on the great economy.
Mr. President, nice to see you.
Thank you, Greta.
Thank you.
Nice to see you. Thank you very much.
China Thursday demanded that Canada free the chief financial officer of the giant Chinese telecom, Huawei, following her arrest Wednesday as the U.S. seeks to have her extradited for alleged Iran sanctions violations. Foreign Ministry spokesman Geng Shuang said China has expressed its solemn position to Canada and the U.S. regarding this case. It demands immediate clarification of the arrest, he said, her release and the safeguarding of her legitimate rights and interests. The arrest of Meng Wanzhou, which occurred December 1st and only made public Wednesday, occurred just days after the U.S. and China agreed to that truce in their tariff and counter-tariff trade tensions. U.S. officials consider Huawei, with its massive cell phone and networking equipment presence, a potential national security threat. Australia and New Zealand had barred Huawei from providing next-generation 5G technology. Britain's largest mobile provider, BT, Wednesday said it was removing the company from providing 5G for its wireless networks over espionage concerns. Media reports indicated a U.S. investigation was launched earlier this year into possible sanctions violations. News of the arrest rankled global markets, and it followed a 7-year ban on the sale of critical U.S. components to China's smartphone maker ZTE over sanctions violations linked to Iran and North Korea. An agreement between the U.S. and China averted the company's collapse. Nelson Wiseman is a political scientist at the University of Toronto. He told VOA's Victor Beattie he expects Canada to follow its Western counterparts in keeping Huawei at arm's length.
The bigger debate going on in Canada is whether Canada should join three of the so-called Five Eyes, which are Australia, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, Canada, and the United States, in avoiding using the Chinese tech company in terms of building out this new technology. The Americans have been the most suspicious, and in fact, a letter received from two American senators, Marco Rubio and Mark Warner, of the Intelligence Committee in the U.S., has gained a fair bit of traction in Canada. There's been debate in the intelligence community over this. a current leader in the intelligence community, a civil servant, says, no, we've got good blocks and this isn't the threat. However, recent heads of our security service, known as CSIS, are very much on the side of going along with the Americans. And I think that view is going to prevail, and that seems to be a growing sentiment among the political class. On the other side, some of our leading telecommunications companies are counting on continuing business with this firm. And I should say that this firm has now many contracts and work with Canadian universities. And I think a lot of academics are naive about how invasive this company can be.
China's embassy in Canada said it resolutely opposes the arrest. Is there a concern that this will damage Canadian-Chinese relations?
Canadian-Chinese relations aren't particularly rosy now. About a year ago, there was talk of a free trade agreement between Canada and China, and the Chinese have been pushing very strongly for this. When the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, was over in China, he was prepared to talk about it, but also wanted elements in such an agreement that dealt with environment, labor issues, and gender issues. The Chinese flatly refused and said we shouldn't compromise any trade deals with what they felt were extraneous issues. And that led to a sort of a frosty standoff. The Chinese continue, through op-eds written by their ambassador here and others, to push for a free trade agreement with China. Some elements in Canadian public policy circles suggest rather than moving toward a free trade agreement, maybe some sectoral agreements could be signed. So that's currently being debated in Canada, but I don't see anything happening for quite a while. Even if you enter into free trade negotiations, they can take off in years to iron out. And clearly the Americans would be very skeptical.
Meng, apprehended in Vancouver, faced a bail hearing Friday. In a statement, U.S. Senator Ben Sasse welcomed her arrest, saying in a statement, sometimes Chinese aggression is explicitly state-sponsored, and sometimes it's laundered through many of Beijing's so-called private sector entities. We're very happy you're with us on VOA Asia Weekend. A new program in Sydney is helping Indigenous Australians quit smoking. It's also exploring the deeper reasons why about a third of Aboriginal adults smoke, a much higher proportion than the national average. Phil Mercer in Sydney told us the organizers of the Talking About Tobacco Use project are warning that high smoking rates are the biggest risk to poor health among Australia's original inhabitants.
First time I quit, had no idea what I was getting myself into. I lasted 3 days and some bright spark gave me a beer. Well, the second time was better. I lasted 6 weeks until my girlfriend decided I was too cranky and gave me a cigarette.
Public health campaigns have helped smoking rates in Australia to fall steadily. But tobacco use in Indigenous communities remains stubbornly high. About a third of Aboriginal adults smoke, including Simone Jordan, an Aboriginal leader involved in setting up a centre in Sydney that's designed to help Australia's original inhabitants give up cigarettes. Jordan is also a participant in the program.
Most of my family did smoke, and it wasn't seen as a bad thing. It wasn't discouraged, and I guess I just thought I was cool for doing it. I guess the goal for us is to get people to quit, help them, make them feel good about it, encourage others. If they fall over, they're not a failure. There's other things we can try and share with people what's working and what's not.
Indigenous Australians die on average 10 years before their non-Aboriginal counterparts. High rates of poverty, inadequate housing, and alcohol and drug abuse are in part to blame. But Professor Renee Batoon, a tobacco treatment specialist, says that smoking causes immense damage.
It's a huge contributor. It's probably the biggest contributor. I'm not saying that other substances aren't a big concern, and they are, but the medical consequences, it's nothing like smoking.
Australia was settled by the British in 1788. Academics argue that high rates of smoking among Aboriginal people are due in part to colonisation. Tobacco was a de facto currency and was widely used in state or church-run missions, where many Indigenous Australians were sent to live in the 19th century in an attempt to assimilate them or to convert them to Christianity. Dr. Raymond Lovett is an epidemiologist at the Australian National University.
Tobacco was used right up until the recent past as payment for labour, and it was also part of the mission rations. Obviously, that legacy has produced this really high smoking prevalence.
Smoking isn't a traditional part of Aboriginal culture, but in some remote settlements, one in two adults smoke. Indigenous Australians make up about 3% of Australia's national population of 25 million people. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, trying to test how far a nation will tolerate aggression. You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. Russia and China are among several countries attempting to stress test the resolve of traditional powers, according to a report from the London-based International Institute for Strategic Studies. It claims so-called challenger powers are persistently testing the West's tolerance for different forms of aggression, from proxy wars to cyber attacks. Henry Ridgewell had the story from London.
Russian forces this week seized three Ukrainian naval vessels in the Sea of Azov off Crimea, the territory Russia forcibly annexed in 2014. Moscow claims these are Russian waters, but a 2003 deal between Moscow and Ukraine agreed the Sea of Azov would be shared. Ukraine warns its Black Sea ports are being cut off. A bridge built by Russia linking it with Crimea now limits the size of ships able to navigate the Kerch Strait. The aim is to change the facts on the ground, part of the Kremlin's strategy of stress-testing the West, says the co-author of the Strategic Survey report, Nick Redman.
They're testing tolerances, probing for weaknesses, getting a measure of the resolve of other states by acts that are generally aggressive but are below the threshold of something that would obviously require a military response.
The IISS report describes a contest between settled versus challenger powers. Iran is also accused of conducting tolerance warfare, using the Revolutionary Guards Corps and proxies across the Middle East to destabilize other countries like Syria. Beijing's activities in the South China Sea are also seen as part of a strategy to test Western resolve in that arena.
China has used not its navy, but say its coast guard or some other at-water capabilities in order to slowly push the envelope in the South China Sea. And obviously the island building campaign and then the growth of infrastructure around there is about, without directly confronting anyone, nevertheless changing facts on the ground.
So how should those on the receiving end of tolerance warfare respond? Redman cites Britain's reaction to the attempted chemical poisoning of a former double agent on British soil earlier this year, which London blamed on the GRU, the intelligence branch of Russia's armed forces.
What we saw was a powerful asymmetric response. Sanctions, a tremendous degree of allied solidarity over diplomatic expulsions, and then an information operation over several months to systematically expose GRU activity.
The report's authors say a new era of geopolitical competition urgently requires new rules governing international behaviour, but negotiating such a global framework is fraught with difficulty. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Monday, South Korean President Moon Jae-in told reporters on a flight from Argentina to New Zealand Sunday that President Donald Trump had told him during the G20 summit that he had very favorable views toward North Korean leader Chairman Kim Jong-un and likes him. The South Korean leader said Mr. Trump asked him to convey to Kim he wants him to implement the rest of their denuclearization agreement from their first meeting in Singapore, and he would fulfill Chairman Kim's wishes. Mr. Trump said Saturday he expects to have a second summit with the North Korean leader in January or February, with three venues for the meeting under consideration. South Korea's unification ministry said it is still possible that Kim will make an unprecedented visit to Seoul before the year is out. Mr. Moon visited Pyongyang in September. Harry Kazianis is director of defense studies at the Center for the National Interest. He told VOA's Victor Beatty the saying is that flattery will get you everything, but he doubts that includes Kim Jong-un's nuclear weapons.
I think right now we're in a little bit of a holding pattern. I think the Trump administration is probably trying to reassess its North Korea policy. I think they understand that Kim Jong-un could very well wait the administration out if he wanted to. Let's face it, he's a 34-year-old young man. He wants to be dictator of North Korea probably until his mid-80s or even longer. So I think he understands his time horizons are a lot longer than Moon Jae-in or Donald Trump. So I think North Korea is also probably thinking about its policy going into the new year. I overall think, though, we're not in a bad position. I know there's been a lot of talk that the talks are collapsing, that they're falling apart. I don't really buy that. I think if you're going to try and create a new relationship with North Korea, which that's what this administration and Moon Jae-in are trying to do, you're not going to do that overnight. You're not going to erase 70 years of animosity, of hatred, of no trust between any of these parties in one summit or five summits. This is going to be a very long-term process that's going to have monumental ups and downs. But the most important thing here that has to be done by Moon, by Trump, and even Kim, is they all have to trust the process and buy into the process. And so far, I think they've done that, but we're a long way to go before we see any really big, tangible results.
There have been criticisms that the Singapore summit last June was very vague in its declarations. If a second summit takes place, will there be more specifics? Will the U.S. insist on it?
I think there has to be some measurable outcome. And I think there is a deal on the table here. When I was actually in Seoul back in September, sort of monitoring events in the third inter-Korean summit, there was a deal that was floated that basically came out of Kim Jong-un's mouth. What he said is he was willing to put the Yongbyon nuclear facility on the table, which is a very large nuclear facility, in exchange for what he dubbed corresponding measures. Those are his words. It's been floated that that could be some sort of sanctions relief, or that could be an end-of-war declaration signed by the United States, North Korea, and South Korea. I think that's what Kim is looking for. Because we have to remember, Kim Jong-un is going to give up his nuclear weapons. His generals, his lieutenants, the party apparatchik around him is going to be very nervous in doing that. We have to remember that is North Korea's insurance policy. Giving that up essentially leaves him naked to invasion. So he needs to get a win to bring back to his own people. Just like any other country, Kim Jong-un has his own political actors that he has to answer to. So I think if Donald Trump was smart, he would give that end-of-war declaration. And I think that would give Kim the ability to start weaning down that nuclear weapons program. I think that there's a real chance of that opening.
And what are the concerns that the North is continuing to build up its nuclear and missile capacity in the meantime?
That was always something that was going to be a danger, and that shouldn't be any shock. Any country that wants to be a full-fledged member of the nuclear club is going to continue to build out its arsenal. There's no shock to that. I know there was, you know, reports in the New York Times saying we're being deceived. We're actually not being deceived, but it is very frightening to see in black and white on the front page of newspapers like the New York Times that literally the satellite imagery that they're building more nuclear weapons. But even a year ago, the North Koreans could kill millions of people with nuclear weapons. They can kill even millions more now. But this is the reason why we need to get an agreement with North Korea. And this is why we need to continue the diplomatic process.
In a statement following the meeting between President Trump and Xi Jinping of China Saturday, the White House said great progress had been made on North Korea, with the goal being a nuclear-free Korean peninsula. As emergency services battled catastrophic bushfires in Queensland and the cleanup after cyclonic conditions in New South Wales, World First Research in Australia revealed the mental health burden borne by first responders. It had found high levels of psychological distress among police officers and other emergency personnel, with a quarter of retired first responders reporting experiences of post-traumatic stress disorder. From Sydney, Phil Mercer had the story.
A modified Boeing 737 passenger aircraft drops 15,000 litres of water on fires near the Queensland city of Mackay. Across the state, emergency crews have been battling more than 100 bushfires. Further south, Sydney, Australia's biggest city, was pounded Wednesday by a once-in-a-100-year storm. An emergency volunteer died in the huge cleanup operation. Greg Murphy is from the New South Wales State Emergency Service.
I can confirm that one of our members, one of the SES family, collapsed and died today while on an SES job. Our sympathies are with the family and all of their colleagues that are actually feeling the effects of this sad event.
For the first time, research in Australia has painted a detailed picture of the psychological health of past and present police officers and other emergency service personnel. The charity Beyond Blue surveyed 21,000 people. It found that those on the front line of natural disasters, accidents and crimes have a higher risk of developing mental health conditions, which are associated with traumatic events as well as poor workplace culture. Steve McDowell is a former paramedic and founded the No More Neglect Help Group to advise those suffering from acute stress.
I developed post-traumatic stress disorder from my workplace. And as a result of my experiences, I formed a support group in 2015. It helps people who are suffering from mental distress who are first responders. A lot of experiences have to do with bullying in the workplace, a lack of support in the workplace, and a feeling of isolation.
The survey found that emergency workers in Australia are about twice as likely to suffer severe psychological distress or be diagnosed with a mental illness than the general population. The research will be used as a framework for the police, as well as the ambulance and fire services, to help workers and volunteers better cope with some of the most challenging and dangerous jobs in Australia.
We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia Weekend. Vietnam, a fast-growing country that's liberal on trade and has friends in multiple countries, is offering to help advance North Korea, a fellow communist state that's impoverished as well as distrusted by the West. North Korea will want to learn from Vietnam how South Korean investors have come to be responsible for about 20% of Vietnamese exports. Sun Seng-woon, economist with the private banking unit of CIMB in Singapore, said the North is looking for an inter-Korean connection.
Kim is more interested in terms of what to learn from Vietnam. So why it failed initially, but it seems to be gaining better traction this time around.
Gaining traction, he says, after the high inflation before the global financial crisis 10 years ago. Southeast Asia beyond Vietnam is on North Korea's radar, too. Last year, the Brookings Institution Research Group said in a report that while China accounts for about 85% to 90% of trade with North Korea, seven Southeast Asian countries did business worth $181 million with Pyongyang in 2015. Brookings adds that some North Korea-Southeast Asia trade may violate UN resolutions and involve arms shipments. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for contributing to this report. You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. President Donald Trump proclaimed last Wednesday a day of national mourning following the death Friday of former President George H.W. Bush at the age of 94, the 41st president who presided over the end of the Cold War and led an international coalition that ousted Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein's forces from Kuwait in 1991. President Bush also served as a U.S. representative to China, the United Nations ambassador, and head of the Central Intelligence Agency. Two men who served in the first Bush administration, former Secretary of State James Baker and former Defense Secretary and Vice President Dick Cheney, appeared on the Fox News Sunday broadcast. Baker described Mr. Bush as among the country's best one-term presidents.
He didn't blow his own horn. One of his wonderful character traits was to let other people take credit. That was something he was brought up with, and that's the way he operated. But he was an extraordinarily, if you think about it, you go back and look at the record, he was an extraordinarily consequential president of the United States, particularly in the arena of foreign affairs.
Former chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff and National Security Advisor Colin Powell said the 41st president, a combat naval aviator in World War II, knew the cost of war and tried to avoid using force in the first Gulf War. He said he led a life of quality, honesty, and humility, and in his public service always kept the best interest of the American people in mind. Larry Sabato is a political science professor at the University of Virginia and the founder and director of its Center for Politics. He told VOA's Victor Beatty Mr. Bush's legacy has grown with time.
It's pretty obvious as people look back and as people are recollecting the Bush presidency, it looks a heck of a lot better than it did at the end of it. Bush, of course, was defeated for re-election, and most people at the time considered him a failed president. But now I think we can see in retrospect that he was actually quite successful, arguably the best one-term president we ever had. He may be tied with John Adams and James K. Polk, but he's at least up at the very top end of a pretty large group of one-term presidents. So it's funny how history works, but the good thing is that with time, you could have reconsideration.
A stellar career, starting with as a young man in the U.S. Navy during the Second World War, a congressman, CIA director, ambassador to China, vice president, and now president. Quite a career.
What a life. What a career. It is amazing. And, of course, Bush was our last World War II veteran to serve as president, so he ended an era. He was a hero in World War II, but he was the son of a senator. And as the son of a senator, he grew up in a political household. So no one was surprised when he started running for office from Texas in the 1960s. What people often forget is he wasn't very successful. He lost two Senate races. He won two races for the House of Representatives. But he went from there to the United Nations. He also served as a liaison to China before we had a full-fledged ambassador. And finally, he was head of the CIA. Then he served after the Carter term. He served two terms as vice president, one term as president. It ended badly with his defeat, but I think all of that was washed away in 2000 when his son was elected president.
You remember the famous words, read my lips, no new taxes, but wasn't that really overshadowed by the fact that he helped win the Cold War or presided over the Cold War, and then, of course, the coalition against Saddam Hussein?
Absolutely. I was 20 yards from the podium when George Bush uttered those words at the Republican National Convention in 1988. And even then, people wondered whether conditions would permit him to keep them. Of course, he did not keep the promise. He did not hold to those words. And it hurt him badly in 1992. Oddly enough, the other thing that hurt him badly was the fact that he skillfully helped the end of the Cold War. He did not grandstand. He didn't run to Berlin to dance on the wall once it had fallen. He realized that these new emerging countries needed time and space and no goading, no grandstanding from the United States to make their way. But essentially, it eliminated foreign policy as a major consideration in the 1992 election, and that helped Bill Clinton, who had no foreign policy experience.
AP leads their story, Bush mourned as great statesman, man of uncommon decency.
To be honest, at one point in history, it would not have been exceptional to have a president who obeyed and appreciated the norms of the American system and of the presidency, who was civil, who was kind to people, and who rose above petty squabbles. But, you know, things have changed, particularly in the last couple of years. And the contrast between George H.W. Bush and the current president could not be more stark.
Mr. Bush's body was in the Capitol Rotunda through last Wednesday. Doctors may soon have new ways of diagnosing and treating patients in ways that were never humanly possible with the help of artificial intelligence and machine learning. A team of scientists at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles are developing a way of using machine learning to identify specific types of breast cancer tumors, and they say it's just the beginning of what the computer can do. VOA's Elizabeth Lee had details from Los Angeles.
This is a classroom for artificial intelligence, or AI. Its teacher, Rishi Rawat, is feeding the computer more samples of cancer cells.
So they're like a computer brain, and you can put the data into them, and they will learn the patterns and the pattern recognition that's important for making decisions.
Decisions by doctors to determine the best treatment for their patients.
Machines are not going to take over the place of doctors.
Computers will not treat patients, but they will help make certain decisions and look for things that the human brain can't recognize these patterns by itself.
For example, once a cancerous tumor is removed from a patient with breast cancer, the doctors still have to treat the patient to reduce the risk of recurrence. The type of treatment depends on the type of cancer and whether the tumor is driven by estrogen.
So what the pathologist has to do is to count what percentage of the cells here are brown versus what percentage are not.
This process could take days or even longer.
In developing nations, they don't necessarily have access to do this at all. And so there's a great need there to be able to diagnose these cancers correctly.
The computer can do something better than just count cells. AI can recognize complicated patterns on how the cells are arranged, with the hope in the near future of making a quick and more reliable diagnosis that is free of human error.
Are they disordered? Are they in irregular spacing? What's going on exactly with the arrangement of cells in the tissue?
We can do this instantaneously for almost no cost in the developing world.
Scientists say the time is ripe for the marriage between computer science and cancer research.
All of a sudden, we have the computing power to really do it in real time. We have the ability of scanning a slide to high enough resolution so that a computer can see every little feature of the cancer. So it's a convergence of technology. We couldn't have done this. We didn't have the computing power to do this several years ago, but now it's all changed.
The research now is on breast cancer, but doctors predict artificial intelligence will eventually be used to help treat patients with all forms of cancer. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Presidents, prime ministers, and Hollywood stars have visited what from the outside may look like an old and shabby jazz club in New Orleans. In this case, however, appearances are quite deceiving. Musicians call this place the Holy Grail of clubs and home to American jazz. Maya Kay went to the famous Preservation Hall that tells the story of jazz.
Nothing reflects America's diverse musical identity than jazz, a genre that originated in the African-American communities of New Orleans, Louisiana. And nowhere is jazz as alive and as vibrant as in its birthplace. But one place in the city is synonymous with the history and cultural tradition of jazz, Preservation Hall.
Immigration and our common ancestry and our common bonds as newcomers to this land is what created this music, and it keeps it fresh.
A house band plays there 5 times a day every day, and there is always a long line waiting to get in, even during weekdays. Preservation Hall is a major tourist magnet in New Orleans' historic French Quarter, which combines cultures and traditions from around the world. The Spanish and French, Creole and American, all left their mark in this city that is like no other in the United States. Preservation Hall hasn't been remodeled since the early 1960s, when musicians were first invited to play in what was then an art gallery. The walls of this historic building are adorned with old photos. The locks are old and rusty. Floorboards creak. The interior, together with the music that's played there, preserves the aura of the club.
We take a boat to the land of dreams. Heaven on earth, they call it New Orleans.
About 18 million tourists visit New Orleans every year to listen to this truly American music. In this city, jazz sets the tone, in parks, over the Mississippi River, and welcoming visitors at the international airport named for Louis Armstrong, jazz legend.
They call it New Orleans.
Maya Kay, VOA News, New Orleans, Louisiana.
It's a street. Long time ago.
VOA Asia Weekend continues. Now that the U.S. and China have reached a truce on their trade war, questions remain about whether the world's two largest economies will be able to achieve a more extensive and definitive deal with the 90 days agreed time frame. Patsy Wodakuswara had this report from the White House.
Stock markets responded positively after the U.S. and China agreed not to impose any new tariffs for the next 90 days while they resolve deep differences and craft a detailed trade agreement. But the two countries offered few details beyond their official statements. White House officials say China vows to move immediately to lift tariff and non-tariff barriers and agrees to over $1 trillion of additional trade commitments.
These things depend on market conditions, as you can imagine. Consumer demands, the state of the economies. The one thing that's really important to me, at least, is reducing the tariffs on these items. That, to me, that's a, quote, structural change, along with reducing non-tariff barriers.
How quickly Beijing delivers will show how serious it is in reaching a deal.
Xi Jinping appears ready to make some very clear, concrete moves that might satisfy the Trump administration. But we can't see this from looking at the respective joint statements because those are very, very different. There's really nothing concrete in the Chinese statement at all.
Analysts see the potential of China opening up its markets, including automobiles and financial services. But Beijing is unlikely to give everything Washington is asking. Ultimately, President Trump may have to accept a compromise, says analysts.
I think there's a pretty good chance because as you get to the middle of 2019, the U.S. economy is likely to be slowing, and it'll be in the interest of the administration to accept some kind of deal rather than ratchet up the trade war again.
Although China has broken past commitments, U.S. officials say negotiations have never gone this far, and both sides understand how much is at stake.
I think President Trump and President Xi have developed a very important relationship. I think as the two largest economies, they both understand the responsibilities that we have.
If Washington and Beijing are unable to reach an agreement by March 1st, the Trump administration plans to raise tariffs to 25%. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
President Donald Trump said he wants to end the arms race. In a tweet Monday, Mr. Trump, at some time in the future, he said, President Xi Jinping, President Vladimir Putin of Russia, and I will start talking about, in his words, a meaningful halt to what has become a major and uncontrollable arms race. He said the $716 billion the U.S. spent on defense this year is crazy. Speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty, John Tierney, executive director of the Washington-based Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, agrees, but said the president is partly to blame.
I think he's right that it's crazy that this country spent $716 billion, but he's as much to blame for it as anybody else. He signed the bill, and he didn't really come back with any alternatives, of which there are plenty. And if he's talking about an arms race that he seems uncontrollable, well, he's aiding and abetting that ability. He can certainly participate in controlling it. The United States always had a leadership role in doing that since the days of Ronald Reagan, and he and John Bolton and company have sort of abdicated that. So I think we should encourage him to have those conversations. We should think about it. The sooner it starts, the better. He ought to do it at a high level with people that understand what they're doing. That we have diplomats that have experience in this area, that are knowledgeable. He just can't go about it as he's been prone to do in the past, sitting down himself and thinking that the three principals are going to chat it out, without doing an awful lot of groundwork and having a lot of people that are very, very knowledgeable about these areas get involved and start working on it.
Do you see a possible opening that would make the presidents of China and Russia amenable to such talks?
I do. Look, even back in the days when Ronald Reagan thought that Russia was the evil empire, and we had any number of disputes and disagreements with that country, that is the Soviet Union, they found a way to separate out the existential issue of nuclear weapons. This is a serious thing that can affect humanity. So we have to be able to do that. And even though we have disagreements with Russia and some contention on trade and other issues with China, we certainly can carve out this issue, the existential threat of nuclear weapons and mistake or miscalculation or other things can go wrong, and start addressing those. And we ought to do that because it opens up a path to have conversations about a host of other things as well. But this is a serious matter, and most people who in this country would love to see some serious negotiations to start to try to decrease the nuclear arsenals, and in fact, the entire arsenals of these countries, to start moving back to the path that we have been on for decades until more recently.
Isn't the president on record as advocating a modernization of the nuclear program?
He's on record. Some Democrats and Republicans are on record. The idea is if you are talking about making sure that what you have as a deterrent is safe and secure, that's one aspect of modernization. And I think people can say, well, if you still believe in deterrence and that's your path, then you do want to make sure things are safe and secure. But if you're using modernization as a ruse to just have an arms race, to have more weapons of different components and different degrees of magnitude and move in that direction, then modernization is not what should be happening.
John Tierney said rather than threatening to withdraw from the 1987 Intermediate Forces Nuclear Treaty with Moscow, the Trump administration should engage the Russians over its concerns of treaty violations. North and South Korea seek to link rail links, while China upgrades rail travel in Argentina. Skylar Ogden was on track with these stories on last week's VOA Asia Business Scene.
A South Korean train recently pulled into North Korea for the first time in a decade. On board were several South Korean officials who, with their North Korean counterparts, will be conducting surveys to link the railway lines between the two countries. South Korea's unification minister, Cho Myung-gyun.
Through the One Connected Railway, South and North Korea will prosper together, and the ground for peace on the Korean Peninsula will be consolidated. The trains running on the track will also carry peace and prosperity with them to Northeast Asia and the world.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and South Korean President Moon Jae-in have held several diplomatic missions this year in an effort to ease rising tensions about the North's nuclear ambitions. Although Washington and Pyongyang have reached a stalemate in their efforts to solve the nuclear standoff, both Kim and Moon have agreed to foster economic cooperation and remain hopeful that international sanctions will be lifted. Cho Myung-gyun.
We will closely consult with the relevant countries going forward to make sure the inter-Korean railway connection project can proceed with the support of the international community.
The joint railway survey plan had been put on hold until recently when the UN Security Council granted sanctions exemptions. The Unification Ministry says that officials will inspect two routes in North Korea, between Kaesong and Sinuiju in the west and Mount Kumgang and the Tumen River in the east, which will ultimately be linked to the south. In more railway news, the Argentine government signed an agreement with state-owned company China Railway Construction Corporation to start the first phase of an upgrade project on the San Martin railway network. The San Martin network in Argentina connects the province of Mendoza and Buenos Aires and ensures the rail freight transport in the country. This is the longest railway project undertaken by a Chinese enterprise in Latin America and is one of several Chinese infrastructure projects across the continent. China has also expanded trade and military ties and provided aid to several governments in the Latin American region. It has also issued billions of dollars in commodities-backed loans across the Americas, helping to open a large share of the region's oil for China to buy. The latest railway project in Argentina will help to increase annual freight traffic and the competitiveness of the transportation system in the country. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
Pollution in the world's lakes, rivers, and bays is creating conditions in which algae thrive, but other forms of life suffer. Scientists have found they can put those algae to work cleaning up that pollution and help generate clean power in the process. VOA's Steve Barragona visited the port of Baltimore to see how it works.
Polluted water flows down this shallow channel. It comes out of the Chesapeake Bay here at the port of Baltimore. But polluted is just how the algae lining the channel like it, says University of Maryland scientist Peter May.
Nature sometimes isn't pretty, but actually it's always pretty. This is what's doing all the work for us right here. That gives us the production that allows us to remove more nutrients from the water.
Around the world, excess nutrients from farm fertilizers and city wastewater set off massive growth of algae. These giant blooms can often be seen from space. But the algal turf scrubber, as the system is called, harnesses those microbes to do good.
Essentially creating a controlled algal bloom on land, which put the algae to work, pulling nutrients out of the water body.
Durham, North Carolina is planning to help clean up a local reservoir with a scrubber. Others are already running in Florida and elsewhere. The thing about algae, though, is they grow a lot.
What do we do with that algae? You have to have an end use, otherwise you're going to pile that algae up very quickly.
Well, it is high in protein, May says. It's been turned into animal feed. It can be fermented into biofuels,
and it makes a great fertilizer. But the University of Maryland's Stephanie Lansing has other plans.
So every week we harvest the algae. With that algae, we actually put it into an anaerobic digestion system.
Inside the digester, microbes break down the algae into methane biogas.
And then the biogas is used to run a fuel cell. The fuel cell is actually a very efficient way of using the energy. You can use it to charge batteries. You can use it for lights. You can use it for fans.
The Port of Baltimore plans a bigger system that could produce a modest amount of renewable electricity, a few hundred kilowatts. That's not bad when you start with just polluted water and algae.
It is beautiful and actually captures people's imagination because you can make that connection that algae is actually doing this work actively for you.
Nature put to work to make clean water and clean power. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Baltimore.
Thank you for being with us for VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You can stay up to date at all times by checking our website at voanews.com.